He escaped from Mecca with his friend Khalid, and the Prophet of Medina enjoyed at the same moment the satisfaction of embracing the two firmest champions of his cause. The impatience of Amru to lead the armies of the faithful was checked by the reproof of Omar, who advised him not to seek power and dominion, since he who is a subject today may be a prince tomorrow. Yet his merit was not overlooked by the two first successors of Muhammad. They were indebted to his arms for the conquest of Palestine, and in all the battles and sieges of Syria he united with the temper of a chief the valor of an adventurous soldier. In a visit to Medina, the caliph expressed a wish to survey the sword which had cut down so many Christian warriors. The son of Azi unsheathed a short and ordinary scimitar, and as he perceived the surprise of Omar, "Alas," said the modest Saracen, "the sword itself, without the arm of its master, is neither sharper nor more weighty than the sword of Farezdak, the poet." After the conquest of Egypt, he was recalled by the jealousy of the caliph Othman. But in the subsequent troubles, the ambition of a soldier, a statesman, and an orator emerged from a private station. His powerful support, both in council and in the field, established the throne of the Umayyads. The administration and revenue of Egypt were restored by the gratitude of Muawiyah to a faithful friend who had raised himself above the rank of a subject. And Amru ended his days in the palace and city which he had founded on the banks of the Nile. His dying speech to his children is celebrated by the Arabians as a model of eloquence and wisdom. He deplored the errors of his youth, but if the penitent was still infected by the vanity of a poet, he might exaggerate the venom and mischief of his impious compositions. From his camp in Palestine, Amru had surprised or anticipated the caliph's leave for the invasion of Egypt. The magnanimous Omar trusted in his god and his sword, which had shaken the thrones of Khosroes and Caesar. But when he compared the slender force of the Muslims with the greatness of the enterprise, he condemned his own rashness and listened to his timid companions. The pride and the greatness of Pharaoh were familiar to the readers of the Quran, and a tenfold repetition of prodigies had been scarcely sufficient to effect not the victory, but the flight of 600,000 of the children of Israel. The cities of Egypt were many and populous. Their architecture was strong and solid. The Nile, with its numerous branches, was alone an insuperable barrier, and the granary of the imperial city would be obstinately defended by the Roman powers. In this perplexity, the commander of the faithful resigned himself to the decision of chance, or, in his opinion, of providence. At the head of only 4,000 Arabs, the intrepid Amru had marched away from his station of Gaza when he was overtaken by the messenger of Omar. "If you are still in Syria," said the ambiguous mandate, "retreat without delay. But if at the receipt of this epistle you have already reached the frontiers of Egypt, advance with confidence and depend on the succor of God and of your brethren." The experience, perhaps the secret intelligence of Amru, had taught him to suspect the mutability of courts, and he continued his march till his tents were unquestionably pitched on Egyptian ground. He there assembled his officers, broke the seal, perused the epistle, gravely inquired the name and situation of the place, and declared his ready obedience to the commands of the caliph. After a siege of 30 days, he took possession of Famah, or Pelusium, and that key of Egypt, as it has been justly named, unlocked the entrance of the country as far as the ruins of Heliopolis and the neighborhood of the modern Cairo. On the western side of the Nile, at a small distance to the east of the pyramids, at a small distance to the south of the delta, Memphis, 150 furlongs in circumference, displayed the magnificence of ancient kings. Under the reign of the Ptolemies and Caesars, the seat of government was removed to the seacoast. The ancient capital was eclipsed by the arts and opulence of Alexandria. The palaces and at length the temples were reduced to a desolate and ruinous condition. Yet in the age of Augustus, and even in that of Constantine, Memphis was still numbered among the greatest and most populous of the provincial cities. The banks of the Nile, in this place of the breadth of 3,000 feet, were united by 2 bridges of 60 and 30 boats, connected in the middle stream by the small island of Rauda, which was covered with gardens and habitations. The eastern extremity of the bridge was terminated by the town of Babylon and the camp of a Roman legion, which protected the passage of the river and the second capital of Egypt. This important fortress, which might fairly be described as a part of Memphis or Misra, was invested by the arms of the lieutenant of Omar. A reinforcement of 4,000 Saracens soon arrived in his camp, and the military engines which battered the walls may be imputed to the art and labor of his Syrian allies. Yet the siege was protracted to 7 months, and the rash invaders were encompassed and threatened by the inundation of the Nile. Their last assault was bold and successful. They passed the ditch, which had been fortified with iron spikes, applied their scaling ladders, entered the fortress with the shout of "God is victorious," and drove the remnant of the Greeks to their boats and the Isle of Rauda. The spot was afterwards recommended to the conqueror by the easy communication with the Gulf and the peninsula of Arabia. The remains of Memphis were deserted. The tents of the Arabs were converted into permanent habitations, and the first mosque was blessed by the presence of 80 companions of Muhammad. A new city arose in their camp, on the eastward bank of the Nile, and the contiguous quarters of Babylon and Fostat are founded in their present decay by the appellation of Old Mizrach, or Cairo, of which they form an extensive suburb. But the name of Cairo, the town of victory, more strictly belongs to the modern capital, which was founded in the 10th century by the Fatimite caliphs. It has gradually receded from the river, but the continuity of buildings may be traced by an attentive eye from the monuments of Sesostris to those of Saladin. Yet the Arabs, after a glorious and profitable enterprise, must have retreated to the desert had they not found a powerful alliance in the heart of the country. The rapid conquest of Alexander was assisted by the superstition and revolt of the natives. They abhorred their Persian oppressors. The disciples of the Magi, who had burnt the temples of Egypt and feasted with sacrilegious appetite on the flesh of the god Apis. After a period of 10 centuries, the same revolution was renewed by a similar cause. And in the support of an incomprehensible creed, the zeal of the Coptic Christians was equally ardent. I have already explained the origin and progress of the Monophysite controversy, and the persecution of the emperors which converted a sect into a nation, and alienated Egypt from their religion and government. The Saracens were received as the deliverers of the Jacobite Church, and a secret and effectual treaty was opened during the siege of Memphis between a victorious army and a people of slaves. A rich and noble Egyptian of the name Mokaukas had dissembled his faith to obtain the administration of his province. In the disorders of the Persian War, he aspired to independence. The embassy of Muhammad ranked him among princes, but he declined, with rich gifts and ambiguous compliments, the proposal of a new religion. The abuse of his trust exposed him to the resentment of Heraclius. His submission was delayed by arrogance and fear, and his conscience was prompted by interest to throw himself on the favor of the nation and the support of the Saracens. In his first conference with Amru, he heard, without indignation, the usual option of the Koran, the tribute or the sword. The Greeks, replied Macaucus, are determined to abide the determination of the sword. But with the Greeks I desire no communion, either in this world or in the next, and I abjure forever the Byzantine tyrant, his synod of Chalcedon, and his Melkite slaves. For myself and my brethren, we are resolved to live and die in the profession of the gospel and unity of Christ. It is impossible for us to embrace the revelations of your prophet, but we are desirous of peace and cheerfully submit to pay tribute and obedience to his temporal successors. The tribute was ascertained at 2 pieces of gold for the head of every Christian, but old men, monks, women, and children of both sexes under 16 years of age were exempted from this personal assessment. The Copts above and below Memphis swore allegiance to the caliph, and promised a hospitable entertainment of 3 days to every Muslim who should travel through their country. By this charter of security, the ecclesiastical and civil tyranny of the Melkites was destroyed. The anathemas of St. Cyril were thundered from every pulpit, and the sacred edifices, with the patrimony of the Church, were restored to the national communion of the Jacobites, who enjoyed, without moderation, the moment of triumph and revenge. At the pressing summons of Amru, their patriarch, Benjamin, emerged from his desert, and after the first interview, the courteous Arab affected to declare that he had never conversed with a Christian priest of more innocent manners and a more venerable aspect. In the march from Memphis to Alexandria, the lieutenant of Omar entrusted his safety to the zeal and gratitude of the Egyptians. The roads and bridges were diligently repaired, and in every step of his progress he could depend on a constant supply of provisions and intelligence. The Greeks of Egypt, whose numbers could scarcely equal a tenth of the natives, were overwhelmed by the universal defection. They had ever been hated. They were no longer feared. The magistrate fled from his tribunal, the bishop from his altar, and the distant garrisons were surprised or starved by the surrounding multitudes. Had not the Nile afforded a safe and ready conveyance to the sea, not an individual could have escaped who, by birth or language or office or religion, was connected with their odious name. By the retreat of the Greeks from the provinces of Upper Egypt, a considerable force was collected in the island of Delta. The natural and artificial channels of the Nile afforded a succession of strong and defensible posts, and the road to Alexandria was laboriously cleared by the victory of the Saracens in 22 days of general or partial combat. In their annals of conquest, the siege of Alexandria is perhaps the most arduous and important enterprise. The first trading city in the world was abundantly replenished with the means of subsistence and defense. Her numerous inhabitants fought for the dearest of human rights, religion, and property, and the enmity of the natives seemed to exclude them from the common benefit of peace and toleration. The sea was continually open, and if Heraclius had been awake to the public distress, fresh armies of Romans and barbarians might have been poured into the harbour to save the second capital of the empire. A circumference of 10 miles would have scattered the forces of the Greeks and favoured the stratagems of an active enemy. But the two sides of an oblong square were covered by the sea and the Lake Mareotis, and each of the narrow ends exposed a front of no more than 10 furlongs. The efforts of the Arabs were not inadequate to the difficulty of the attempt and the value of the prize. From the throne of Medina, the eyes of Omar were fixed on the camp and city. His voice excited to arms the Arabian tribes and the veterans of Syria, and the merit of a holy war was recommended by the peculiar fame and fertility of Egypt. Anxious for the ruin or expulsion of their tyrants, the faithful natives devoted their labors to the service of Amru. Some sparks of martial spirit were perhaps rekindled by the example of their allies, and the sanguine hopes of Macaucus had fixed his sepulchre in the church of St. John of Alexandria. Eutychius the Patriarch observes that the Saracens fought with the courage of lions. They repulsed the frequent and almost daily sallies of the besieged, and soon assaulted in their turn the walls and towers of the city. In every attack, the sword, the banner of Amru, glittered in the van of the Muslims. On a memorable day, he was betrayed by his imprudent valor. His followers, who had entered the citadel, were driven back, and the general, with a friend and slave, remained a prisoner in the hands of the Christians. When Amru was conducted before the prefect, he remembered his dignity and forgot his situation. A lofty demeanor and resolute language revealed the lieutenant of the caliph, and the battle-axe of a soldier was already raised to strike off the head of the audacious captive. His life was saved by the readiness of his slave, who instantly gave his master a blow on the face and commanded him with an angry tone to be silent in the presence of his superiors. The credulous Greek was deceived. He listened to the offer of a treaty, and his prisoners were dismissed in the hope of a more respectable embassy, until the joyful acclamations of the camp announced the return of their general and insulted the folly of the infidels. At length, after a siege of 14 months and the loss of 23,000 men, the Saracens prevailed. The Greeks embarked their dispirited and diminished numbers, and the standard of Mohammed was planted on the walls of the capital of Egypt. "I have taken," said Amru to the caliph, "the greatest city of the West. It is impossible for me to enumerate the variety of its riches and beauty, and I shall content myself with observing that it contains 4,000 palaces, 4,000 baths, 400 theatres or places of amusement, 12,000 shops for the sale of vegetable food, and 40,000 tributary Jews. The town has been subdued by force of arms, without treaty or capitulation, and the Muslims are impatient to seize the fruits of their victory." The commander of the faithful rejected with firmness the idea of pillage, and directed his lieutenant to reserve the wealth and revenue of Alexandria for the public service and the propagation of the faith. The inhabitants were numbered. A tribute was imposed. The zeal and resentment of the Jacobites were curbed. And the Melchites, who submitted to the Arabian yoke, were indulged in the obscure but tranquil exercise of their workshop. The intelligence of this disgraceful and calamitous event afflicted the declining health of the emperor, and Heraclius died of a dropsy about 7 weeks after the loss of Alexandria. Under the minority of his grandson, the clamors of a people, deprived of their daily sustenance, compelled the Byzantine court to undertake the recovery of the capital of Egypt. In the space of 4 years, the harbor and fortifications of Alexandria were twice occupied by a fleet and army of Romans. They were twice expelled by the valor of Amru, who was recalled by the domestic peril from the distant wars of Tripoli and Nubia. But the facility of the attempt, the repetition of the insult, and the obstinacy of the resistance provoked him to swear that if a third time he drove the infidels into the sea, he would render Alexandria as accessible on all sides as the house of a prostitute. Faithful to his promise, he dismantled several parts of the walls and towers. But the people were spared in the chastisement of the city, and the Mosque of Mercy was erected on the spot where the victorious general had stopped the fury of his troops. I should deceive the expectation of the reader if I passed in silence the fate of the Alexandrian library, as it is described by the learned Abulpharagius. The spirit of Amru was more curious and liberal than that of his brethren, and in his leisure hours the Arabian chief was pleased with the conversation of John, the last disciple of Ammonius, and who derived the surname of Philoponus from his laborious studies of grammar and philosophy. Emboldened by this familiar intercourse, Philoponus presumed to solicit a gift, inestimable in his opinion, contemptible in that of the barbarians. The royal library, which alone among the spoils of Alexandria, had not been appropriated by the visit and the seal of the conqueror. Amru was inclined to gratify the wish of the grammarian, but his rigid integrity refused to alienate the minutest object without the consent of the caliph, and the well-known answer of Omar was inspired by the ignorance of a fanatic. If these writings of the Greeks agree with the Book of God, they are useless and need not be preserved. If they disagree, they are pernicious and ought to be destroyed. The sentence was executed with blind obedience. The volumes of paper or parchment were distributed to the 4,000 baths of the city, and such was their incredible multitude that 6 months were barely sufficient for the consumption of this precious fuel. Since the dynasties of Abulpharagius have been given to the world in a Latin version, the tale has been repeatedly transcribed, and every scholar with pious indignation has deplored the irreparable shipwreck of the learning, the arts, and the genius of antiquity. For my own part, I am strongly tempted to deny both the fact and the consequences. The fact is indeed marvelous. Read and wonder, says the historian himself, and the solitary report of a stranger who wrote at the end of 600 years on the confines of Media is overbalanced by the silence of 2 analysts of a more early date, both Christians, both natives of Egypt, and the most ancient of whom, the patriarch Eutychius, has amply described the conquest of Alexandria. The rigid sentence of Omar is repugnant to the sound and orthodox precept of the Mohammedan causists. They expressly declare that the religious books of the Jews and Christians, which are acquired by the right of war, should never be committed to the flames, and that the works of profane science, historians, or poets, physicians, or philosophers, may be lawfully applied to the use of the faithful. A more destructive zeal may perhaps be attributed to the first successors of Muhammad, yet in this instance the conflagration would have speedily expired in the deficiency of materials. I should not recapitulate the disasters of the Alexandrian library, the involuntary flame that was kindled by Caesar in his own defense, or the mischievous bigotry of the Christians who studied to destroy the monuments of idolatry. But if we gradually descend from the age of the Antonines to that of Theodosius, we shall learn from a chain of contemporary witnesses that the royal palace and the temple of Serapis no longer contained the 400,000 or 700,000 volumes which had been assembled by the curiosity and magnificence of the Ptolemies. Perhaps the church and seat of the patriarchs might be enriched with a repository of books, but if the ponderous mass of Arian and Monophysite controversy were indeed consumed in the public baths, a philosopher may allow with a smile that it was ultimately devoted to the benefit of mankind. I sincerely regret the more valuable libraries which have been involved in the ruin of the Roman Empire, but when I seriously compute the lapse of ages, the waste of ignorance, and the calamities of war, our treasures, rather than our losses, are the objects of my surprise. Many curious and interesting facts are buried in oblivion. The 3 great historians of Rome have been transmitted to our hands in a mutilated state, and we are deprived of many pleasing compositions of the lyric iambic, and dramatic poetry of the Greeks. Yet we should gratefully remember that the mischances of time and accident have spared the classic works to which the suffrage of antiquity had adjudged the first place of genius and glory. The teachers of ancient knowledge who are still extant had perused and compared the writings of their predecessors, nor can it fairly be presumed that any important truth, any useful discovery in art or nature, has been snatched away from the curiosity of modern ages. In the administration of Egypt, Amru balanced the demands of justice and policy, the interest of the people of the law, who were defended by God, and of the people of the alliance, who were protected by man. In the recent tumult of conquest and deliverance, the tongue of the Copts and the sword of the Arabs were most adverse to the tranquillity of the province. To the former, Amru declared that faction and falsehood would be doubly chastised by the punishment of the accusers, whom he should detest as his personal enemies, and by the promotion of their innocent brethren, whom their envy had labored to injure and supplant. He excited the latter by the motives of religion and honor to sustain the dignity of their character, to endear themselves by modest and temperate conduct to God and the Caliph, to spare and protect a people who had trusted to their faith, and to content themselves with the legitimate and splendid rewards of their victory. In the management of the revenue, he disapproved the simple but oppressive mode of a capitation, and preferred, with reason, a proportion of taxes deducted on every branch from the clear profits of agriculture and commerce. A third part of the tribute was appropriated to the annual repairs of the dikes and canals, so essential to the public welfare. Under his administration, the fertility of Egypt supplied the dearth of Arabia, and a string of camels, laden with corn and provisions, covered almost without an interval the long road from Memphis to Medina. But the genius of Amru soon renewed the maritime communication which had been attempted or achieved by the Pharaohs, the Ptolemies, or the Caesars, and a canal, at least 80 miles in length, was opened from the Nile to the Red Sea. This inland navigation, which would have joined the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean, was soon discontinued as useless and dangerous. The throne was removed from Medina to Damascus, and the Grecian fleets might have explored a passage to the holy cities of Arabia. Of his new conquest, the Caliph Omar had an imperfect knowledge from the voice of fame and the legends of the Quran. He requested that his lieutenant would place before his eyes the realm of Pharaoh and the Amalekites, and the answer of Amru exhibits a lively and not unfaithful picture of that singular country. O Commander of the Faithful, Egypt is a compound of black earth and green plants between a pulverized mountain and a red sand. The distance from Syene to the sea is a month's journey for a horseman. Along the valley descends a river on which the blessing of the Most High reposes both in the evening and morning, and which rises and falls with the revolutions of the sun and moon. When the annual dispensation of providence unlocks the springs and fountains that nourish the earth, the Nile rolls his swelling and sounding waters through the realm of Egypt. The fields are overspread by the salutary flood, and the villages communicate with each other in their painted barks. The retreat of the inundation deposits a fertilizing mud for the reception of the various seeds. The crowds of husbandmen who blacken the land may be compared to a swarm of industrious ants, and their native indolence is quickened by the lash of the taskmaster, and the promise of the flowers and fruits of a plentiful increase. Their hope is seldom deceived, but the riches which they extract from the wheat, the barley, and the rice, the legumes, the fruit trees, and the cattle, are unequally shared between those who labor and those who possess. According to the vicissitudes of the seasons, the face of the country is adorned with a silver wave, a verdant emerald, and the deep yellow of a golden harvest. Yet this beneficial order is sometimes interrupted, and the long delay and sudden swell of the river in the first year of the conquest might afford some color to an edifying fable. It is said that the annual sacrifice of a virgin had been interdicted by the piety of Omar, and that the Nile lay sullen and inactive in his shallow bed, till the mandate of the caliph was cast into the obedient stream, which rose in a single night to the height of 16 cubits. The admiration of the Arabs for their new conquest encouraged the license of their romantic spirit. We may read in the gravest authors that Egypt was crowded with 20,000 cities or villages, that, exclusive of the Greeks and Arabs, the Copts alone were found on the assessment 6 millions of tributary subjects, or 20 millions of either sex and of every age, that 300 millions of gold or silver were annually paid to the treasury of the caliphs. Our reason must be startled by these extravagant assertions, and they will become more palpable if we assume the compass and measure the extent of habitable ground. A valley from the tropic to Memphis, seldom broader than 12 miles, and the triangle of the delta, a flat surface of 2,100 square leagues, compose a 1/12 part of the magnitude of France. A more accurate research will justify a more reasonable estimate. The 300 millions created by the error of a scribe are reduced to the decent revenue of 4,300,000 pieces of gold, of which 900,000 were consumed by the pay of the soldiers. Two authentic lists of the present and of the 12th century are circumscribed within the respectable number of 2,700 villages and towns. After a long residence at Cairo, a French consul has ventured to assign about 4 millions of Mohammedans, Christians, and Jews for the ample, though not incredible, scope of the population of Egypt. The conquest of Africa from the Nile to the Atlantic Ocean was first attempted by the arms of the Caliph Othman. The pious design was approved by the companions of Mohammed and the chiefs of the tribes, and 20,000 Arabs marched from Medina with the gifts and the blessing of the commander of the faithful. They were joined in the camp of Memphis by 20,000 of their countrymen, and the conduct of the war was entrusted to Abdallah, the son of Said and the foster brother of the caliph, who had lately supplanted the conqueror and lieutenant of Egypt. Yet the favor of the prince and the merit of his favorite could not obliterate the guilt of his apostasy. The early conversion of Abdallah and his skillful pen had recommended to him the important office of transcribing the sheets of the Quran. He betrayed the trust, corrupted the text, derided the errors which he had made, and fled to Mecca to escape the justice and expose the ignorance of the apostle. After the conquest of Mecca, he fell prostrate at the feet of Mohammed. His tears and the entreaties of Othman extorted a reluctant pardon. But the prophet declared that he had so long hesitated to allow time for some zealous disciple to avenge his injury in the blood of the apostate. With apparent fidelity and effective merit, he served the religion which it was no longer his interest to desert. His birth and talents gave him an honorable rank among the Quraysh, and in a nation of cavalry, Abdallah was renowned as the boldest and most dexterous horseman of Arabia. At the head of 40,000 Muslims, he advanced from Egypt into the unknown countries of the West. The sands of Barca might be impervious to a Roman legion, but the Arabs were attended by their faithful camels, and the natives of the desert beheld, without terror, the familiar aspect of the soil and climate. After a painful march, they pitched their tents before the walls of Tripoli, a maritime city in which the name, the wealth, and the inhabitants of the province had gradually settled, and which now maintains the third rank among the states of Barbary. A reinforcement of Greeks was surprised and cut in pieces on the seashore, but the fortifications of Tripoli resisted the first assaults, and the Saracens were tempted by the approach of the prefect Gregory to relinquish the labors of the siege for the perils and the hopes of a decisive action. If his standard was followed by 120,000 men, the regular bands of the empire must have been lost in the naked and disorderly crowd of Africans and Moors who formed the strength, or rather the numbers, of his host. He rejected with indignation the option of the Quran or the tribute, and during several days the two armies were fiercely engaged from the dawn of light to the hour of noon, when their fatigue and the excessive heat compelled them to seek shelter and refreshment in their respective camps. The daughter of Gregory, a maid of incomparable beauty and spirit, is said to have fought by his side. From her earliest youth she was trained to mount on horseback, to draw the bow, and to wield the scimitar, and the richness of her arms and apparel were conspicuous in the foremost ranks of the battle. Her hand, with 100,000 pieces of gold, was offered for the head of the Arabian general, and the youths of Africa were excited by the prospect of the glorious prize. At the pressing solicitation of his brethren, Abdallah withdrew his person from the field, but the Saracens were discouraged by the retreat of their leader and the repetition of these equal or unsuccessful conflicts. A noble Arabian, who afterwards became the adversary of Ali and the father of a caliph, had signalized his valor in Egypt and Zobeir, was the first who planted the scaling ladder against the walls of Babylon. In the African war he was detached from the standard of Abdallah. On the news of the battle, Zobeir, with 12 companions, cut his way through the camp of the Greeks and pressed forwards, without tasting either food or repose, to partake of the dangers of his brethren. He cast his eyes round the field. "Where," said he, "is our general?" "In his tent." "Is the tent a station for the general of the Muslims?" Abdallah represented with a blush the importance of his own life, and the temptation that was held forth by the Roman prefect. "Retort," said Zobeir, "on the infidels their ungenerous attempt. Proclaim through the ranks that the head of Gregory shall be repaid with his captive daughter, and the equal sum of 100,000 pieces of gold." To the courage and discretion of Zobeir, the lieutenant of the caliph entrusted the execution of his own stratagem, which inclined the long-disputed balance in favor of the Saracens. Supplying by activity and artifice the deficiency of numbers, a part of their forces lay concealed in their tents, while the remainder prolonged an irregular skirmish with the enemy till the sun was high in the heavens. On both sides they retired with fainting steps. Their horses were unbridled, their armor was laid aside, and the hostile nations prepared, or seemed to prepare, for the refreshment of the evening and the encounter of the ensuing day. On a sudden the charge was sounded. The Arabian camp poured forth a swarm of fresh and intrepid warriors, and the long line of the Greeks and Africans was surprised, assaulted, overturned by new squadrons of the faithful, who, to the eye of fanaticism, might appear as a band of angels descending from the sky. The prefect himself was slain by the hand of Zobeir. His daughter, who sought revenge and death, was surrounded and made prisoner, and the fugitives involved in their disaster the town of Sufetula, to which they escaped from the sabers and lances of the Arabs. Sufetula was built 150 miles to the south of Carthage, A gentle declivity is watered by a running stream, and shaded by a grove of juniper trees. And in the ruins of a triumphal arch, a portico, and three temples of the Corinthian order, curiosity may yet admire the magnificence of the Romans. After the fall of this opulent city, the provincials and barbarians implored on all sides the mercy of the conqueror. His vanity or his zeal might be flattered by offers of tribute or professions of faith, but his losses, his fatigues, and the progress of an epidemical disease prevented a solid establishment. And the Saracens, after a campaign of 15 months, retreated to the confines of Egypt with the captives and the wealth of their African expedition. The Caliph's fifth was granted to a favorite on the nominal payment of 500,000 pieces of gold. But the state was doubly injured by this fallacious transaction if each foot soldier had shared 1,000 and each horseman 3,000 pieces in the real division of the plunder. The author of The Death of Gregory was expected to have claimed the most precious reward of the victory. From his silence it might be presumed that he had fallen in the battle, till the tears and exclamations of the prefect's daughter at the sight of Zobeir revealed the valor and modesty of that gallant soldier. The unfortunate virgin was offered and almost rejected as a slave by her father's murderer, who coolly declared that his sword was consecrated to the service of religion, and that he labored for a recompense far above the charms of mortal beauty or the riches of this transitory life. A reward congenial to his temper was the honorable commission of announcing to the Caliph Othman the success of his arms. The companions, the chiefs, and the people were assembled in the mosque of Medina to hear the interesting narrative of Zobeir, and as the orator forgot nothing except the merit of his own counsels and actions, the name of Abdallah was joined by the Arabians with the heroic names of Khalid and Amru. The western conquests of the Saracens were suspended near 20 years, till their dissensions were composed by the establishment of the House of Omiyyah, and the Caliph Muawiyah was invited by the cries of the Africans themselves. The successors of Heraclius had been informed of the tribute which they had been compelled to stipulate with the Arabs. But instead of being moved to pity and relieve their distress, they imposed as an equivalent or a fine a second tribute of a similar amount. The ears of the Zantine ministers were shut against the complaints of their poverty and ruin. Their despair was reduced to prefer the dominion of a single master, and the extortions of the Patriarch of Carthage, who was invested with civil and military power, provoked the sectaries and even the Catholics of the Roman province to abjure the religion as well as the authority of their tyrants. The first lieutenant of Muawiyah acquired a just renown, subdued an important city, defeated an army of 30,000 Greeks, swept away 80,000 captives, and enriched with their spoils the bold adventurers of Syria and Egypt. But the title of conqueror of Africa is more justly due to his successor Akhbah. He marched from Damascus at the head of 10,000 of the bravest Arabs, and the genuine force of the Muslims was enlarged by the doubtful aid and conversion of many thousand barbarians. It would be difficult, nor is it necessary, to trace the accurate line of the progress of Akbah. The interior regions have been peopled by the Orientals with fictitious armies and imaginary citadels. In the warlike province of Zab, or Numidia, 80,000 of the natives might assemble in arms, but the number of 360 towns is incompatible with the ignorance or decay of husbandry, and a circumference of 3 leagues will not be justified by the ruins of Erbi or Lambesa, the ancient metropolis of that inland country. As we approach the seacoast, the well-known titles of Bugia and Tangier define the more certain limits of the Saracen victories. A remnant of trade still adheres to the commodious harbour of Bugia, which in a more prosperous age is said to have contained about 20,000 houses. And the plenty of iron which is dug from the adjacent mountains might have supplied a braver people with the instruments of defence. The remote position and venerable antiquity of Tingi, or Tangier, have been decorated by the Greek and Arabian fables. But the figurative expressions of the latter, that the walls were constructed of brass, and that the roofs were covered with gold and silver, may be interpreted as the emblems of strength and opulence. The province of Mauritania, Tingitana, which assumed the name of the capital, had been imperfectly discovered and settled by the Romans. The five colonies were confined to a narrow pale, and the more southern parts were seldom explored except by the agents of luxury, who searched the forests for ivory and the citron wood, and the shores of the ocean for the purple shellfish. The fearless Achbach plunged into the heart of the country, traversed the wilderness in which his successors erected the splendid capitals of Fez and Morocco, and at length penetrated to the verge of the Atlantic and the great desert. The river Suz descends from the western sides of Mount Atlas, fertilizes, like the Nile, the adjacent soil, and falls into the sea at a moderate distance from the Canary or adjacent islands. Its banks were inhabited by the last of the Moors, a race of savages without laws or discipline or religion. They were astonished by the strange and irresistible terrors of the Oriental arms, and as they possessed neither gold nor silver, the richest spoil was the beauty of the female captives, some of whom were afterwards sold for 1,000 pieces of gold. The career, though not the zeal, of Achbach was checked by the prospect of a boundless ocean. He spurred his horse into the waves, and raising his eyes to heaven, exclaimed with the tone of a fanatic, "Great God, if my course were not stopped by this sea, I would still go on to the unknown kingdoms of the West, preaching the unity of thy holy name, and putting to the sword the rebellious nations who worship another god than thee." Yet this Mohammedan Alexander, who sighed for new worlds, was unable to preserve his recent conquests. By the universal defection of the Greeks and Africans, he was recalled from the shores of the Atlantic, and the surrounding multitudes left him only the resource of an honourable death. The last scene was dignified by an example of national virtue. An ambitious chief, who had disputed the command and failed in the attempt, was led about as a prisoner in the camp of the Arabian general. The insurgents had trusted to his discontent and revenge. He disdained their offers and revealed their designs. In the hour of danger, the grateful Achbach unlocked his fetters and advised him to retire. He chose to die under the banner of his rival. Embracing as friends and martyrs, they unsheathed their scimitars, broke their scabbards, and maintained an obstinate combat till they fell by each other's side on the last of their slaughtered countrymen. The third general or governor of Africa, Zuhair, avenged and encountered the fate of his predecessor. He vanquished the natives in many battles. He was overthrown by a powerful army which Constantinople had sent to the relief of Carthage. It had been the frequent practice of the Moorish tribes to join the invaders, to share the plunder, to profess the faith, and to revolt in their savage state of independence and idolatry on the first retreat or misfortune of the Muslims. The prudence of Achbach had proposed to found an Arabian colony in the heart of Africa, a citadel that might curb the levity of the barbarians, a place of refuge to secure, against the accidents of war, the wealth and the families of the Saracens. With this view and under the modest title of the station of a caravan, he planted this colony in the 50th year of the Hegira. In its present decay, Cairoan still holds the second rank in the kingdom of Tunis, from which it is distant about 50 miles to the south. Its inland situation, 12 miles westward of the sea, has protected the city from the Greek and Sicilian fleets. When the wild beasts and serpents were extirpated, when the forest, or rather wilderness, was cleared, the vestiges of a Roman town were discovered in a sandy plain. The vegetable food of Cairoan is brought from afar, and the scarcity of springs constrains the inhabitants to collect in cisterns and reservoirs a precarious supply of rainwater. These obstacles were subdued by the industry of Akbach. He traced a circumference of 3,600 paces, which he encompassed with a brick wall. In the space of 5 years, the governor's palace was surrounded with a sufficient number of private habitations. A spacious mosque was supported by 500 columns of granite, porphyry, and Numidian marble, and Cairoan became the seat of learning as well as of empire. But these were the glories of a later age. The new colony was shaken by the successive defeats of Akbach and Zuhir, and the western expeditions were again interrupted by the civil discord of the Arabian monarchy. The son of the valiant Zubayr maintained a war of 12 years, a siege of 7 months, against the house of Umayyah. Abdallah was said to unite the fierceness of the lion with the subtlety of the fox, but if he inherited the courage, he was devoid of the generosity of his father. The return of domestic peace allowed the caliph Abd al-Malik to resume the conquest of Africa. The standard was delivered to Hassan, governor of Egypt, and the revenue of that kingdom, with an army of 40,000 men, was consecrated to the important service. In the vicissitudes of war, the interior provinces had been alternately won and lost by the Saracens. But the seacoast still remained in the hands of the Greeks. The predecessors of Hassan had respected the name and fortifications of Carthage, and the number of its defenders was recruited by the fugitives of Cabiz and Tripoli. The arms of Hassan were bolder and more fortunate. He reduced and pillaged the metropolis of Africa, and the mention of scaling ladders may justify the suspicion that he anticipated by a sudden assault the more tedious operations of a regular siege. But the joy of the conquerors was soon disturbed by the appearance of the Christian succors. The prefect and patrician John, a general of experience and renown, embarked at Constantinople the forces of the Eastern Empire. They were joined by the ships and soldiers of Sicily, and a powerful reinforcement of Goths was obtained from the fears and religion of the Spanish monarch. The weight of the Confederate navy broke the chain that guarded the entrance of the harbor. The Arabs retired to Cairoan, or Tripoli. The Christians landed, the citizens hailed the ensign of the cross, and the winter was idly wasted in the dream of victory or deliverance. But Africa was irrecoverably lost. The zeal and resentment of the commander of the faithful prepared in the ensuing spring a more numerous armament by sea and land, and the patrician in his turn was compelled to evacuate the post and fortifications of Carthage. A second battle was fought in the neighborhood of Utica, and the Greeks and Goths were again defeated, and their timely embarkation saved them from the sword of Hassan, who had invested the slight and insufficient rampart of their camp. Whatever yet remained of Carthage was delivered to the flames, and the colony of Dido and Caesar lay desolate above 200 years, till a part, perhaps a twentieth, of the old circumference was repeopled by the first of the Fatimite caliphs. In the beginning of the 16th century, the second capital of the West was represented by a mosque, a college without students, 25 or 30 shops, and the huts of 500 peasants, who in their abject poverty displayed the arrogance of the Punic senators. Even that paltry village was swept away by the Spaniards whom Charles V had stationed in the fortress of the Goletta. The ruins of Carthage have perished, and the place might be unknown if some broken arches of an aqueduct did not guide the footsteps of the inquisitive traveller. The Greeks were expelled, but the Arabians were not yet masters of the country. In the interior provinces, the Moors, or Berbers, so feeble under the first Caesars, so formidable to the Byzantine princes, maintained a disorderly resistance to the religion and power of the successors of Muhammad. Under the standard of their queen, Kahina, the independent tribes acquired some degree of union and discipline, and as the Moors respected in their females the character of a prophetess, they attacked the invaders with an enthusiasm similar to their own. The veteran bands of Hassan were inadequate to the defense of Africa. The conquests of an age were lost in a single day, and the Arabian chief, overwhelmed by the torrent, retired to the confines of Egypt and expected 5 years the promised succors of the caliph. After the retreat of the Saracens, the victorious prophetess assembled the Moorish chiefs and recommended a measure of strange and savage policy. "Our cities," said she, "and the gold and silver which they contain perpetually attract the arms of the Arabs. These vile metals are not the objects of our ambition. We content ourselves with the simple productions of the earth. Let us destroy these cities. Let us bury in their ruins those pernicious treasures. And when the avarice of our foes shall be destitute of temptation, perhaps they will cease to disturb the tranquility of a warlike people." The proposal was accepted with unanimous applause. From Tangier to Tripoli, the buildings, or at least the fortifications, were demolished. The fruit trees were cut down. The means of subsistence were extirpated. A fertile and populous garden was changed into a desert, and the historians of a more recent period could discern the frequent traces of the prosperity and devastation of their ancestors. Such is the tale of the modern Arabians. Yet I strongly suspect that their ignorance of antiquity, the love of the marvelous, and the fashion of extolling the philosophy of barbarians has induced them to describe, as one voluntary act, the calamities of 300 years since the first fury of the Donatists and Vandals. In the progress of the revolt, Kahina had most probably contributed her share of destruction, and the alarm of universal ruin might terrify and alienate the cities that had reluctantly yielded to her unworthy yoke. They no longer hoped, perhaps they no longer wished, the return of their Byzantine sovereigns. Their present servitude was not alleviated by the benefits of order and justice, and the most zealous Catholic must prefer the imperfect truths of the Koran to the blind and rude idolatry of the Moors. The general of the Saracens was again received as the savior of the province. The friends of civil society conspired against the savages of the land, and the royal prophetess was slain in the first battle which overturned the baseless fabric of her superstition and empire. The same spirit revived under the successor of Hassan. It was finally quelled by the activity of Musa and his two sons, but the number of the rebels may be presumed from that of 300,000 captives, 60,000 of whom, the caliph's fifth, were sold for the profit of the public treasury. 30,000 of the barbarian youth were enlisted in the troops, and the pious labors of Musa to inculcate the knowledge and practice of the Koran accustomed the Africans to obey the apostle of God and the commander of the faithful. In their climate and government, their diet and habitation, the wandering Moors resembled the Bedouins of the desert. With the religion, they were proud to adopt the language, name, and origin of Arabs. The blood of the strangers and natives was insensibly mingled, and from the Euphrates to the Atlantic, the same nation might seem to be diffused over the sandy plains of Asia and Africa. Yet I will not deny that 50,000 tents of pure Arabians might be transported over the Nile and scattered through the Libyan desert, and I am not ignorant that 5 of the Moorish tribes still retain their barbarous idiom with the appellation and character of white Africans. In the progress of conquest from the north and south, the Goths and the Saracens encountered each other on the confines of Europe and Africa. In the opinion of the latter, the difference of religion is a reasonable ground of enmity in warfare. As early as the time of Othman, their piratical squadrons had ravaged the coast of Andalusia, nor had they forgotten the relief of Carthage by the Gothic succors. In that age, as well as in the present, the kings of Spain were possessed of the fortress of Ceuta, one of the columns of Hercules, which is divided by a narrow strait from the opposite pillar or point of Europe. A small portion of Mauritania was still wanting to the African conquest, but Musa, in the pride of victory, was repulsed from the walls of Ceuta by the vigilance and courage of Count Julian, the general of the Goths. From his disappointment and perplexity, Musa was relieved by an unexpected message of the Christian chief, who offered his place, his person, and his sword to the successors of Muhammad, and solicited the disgraceful honor of introducing their arms into the heart of Spain. If we inquire into the cause of this treachery, the Spaniards will repeat the popular story of his daughter Cava, of a virgin who was seduced or ravished by her sovereign, of a father who sacrificed his religion and country to the thirst of revenge. The passions of princes have often been licentious and destructive, but this well-known tale, romantic in itself, is indifferently supported by external evidence, and the history of Spain will suggest some motives of interest and policy more congenial to the breast of a veteran statesman. After the decease or deposition of Witiza, his 2 sons were supplanted by the ambition of Roderick, a noble Goth, whose father, the duke or governor of a province, had fallen a victim to the preceding tyranny. The monarchy was still elective, but the sons of Witiza, educated on the steps of the throne, were impatient of a private station. Their resentment was the more dangerous as it was varnished with the dissimulation of courts. Their followers were excited by the remembrance of favors and the promise of a revolution, and their uncle Opas, Archbishop of Toledo and Seville, was the first person in the church and the second in the state. It is probable that Julian was involved in the disgrace of the unsuccessful faction, that he had little to hope and much to fear from the new reign, and that the imprudent king could not forget or forgive the injuries which Roderick and his family had sustained. The merit and influence of the count rendered him a useful or formidable subject. His estates were ample, his followers bold and numerous, and it was too fatally shown that, by his Andalusian and Mauritanian commands, he held in his hands the keys of the Spanish monarchy. Too feeble, however, to meet his sovereign in arms, he sought the aid of a foreign power, and his rash invitation of the Moors and Arabs produced the calamities of 800 years. In his epistles, or in a personal interview, he revealed the wealth and nakedness of his country, the weakness of an unpopular prince, the degeneracy of an effeminate people. The Goths were no longer the victorious barbarians who had humbled the pride of Rome, despoiled the queen of nations, and penetrated from the Danube to the Atlantic Ocean. Secluded from the world by the Pyrenean mountains, the successors of Alaric had slumbered in a long peace. The walls of the city were moulded into dust. The youth had abandoned the exercise of arms, and the presumption of their ancient renown would expose them in a field of battle to the first assault of the invaders. The ambitious Saracen was fired by the ease and importance of the attempt, but the execution was delayed till he had consulted the commander of the faithful, and his messenger returned with the permission of Walid to annex the unknown kingdoms of the West to the religion and throne of the caliphs. In his residence of Tangier, Musa, with secrecy and caution, continued his correspondence and hastened his preparations. But the remorse of the conspirators was soothed by the fallacious assurance that he should content himself with the glory and spoil without aspiring to establish the Muslims beyond the sea that separates Africa from Europe. Before Musa would trust an army of the faithful to the traitors and infidels of a foreign land, he made a less dangerous trial of their strength and veracity. 100 Arabs and 400 Africans passed over in 4 vessels from Tangier or Ceuta. The place of their descent on the opposite shore of the strait is marked by the name of Tarif, their chief, and the date of this memorable event is fixed to the month of Ramadan, of the 91st year of the Hegira, to the month of July, 748 years from the Spanish era of Caesar, 710 after the birth of Christ. From their first station they marched 18 miles through a hilly country to the castle and town of Julian, on which it is still called Al-Jazire. They bestowed the name of the Green Island from a verdant cape that advances into the sea. Their hospitable entertainment, the Christians who joined their standard, their inroad into a fertile and unguarded province, the richness of their spoil and the safety of their return, announced to their brethren the most favorable omens of victory. In the ensuing spring, 5,000 veterans and volunteers were embarked under the command of Tariq, a dauntless and skillful soldier who surpassed the expectation of his chief, and the necessary transports were provided by the industry of their too faithful ally. The Saracens landed at the pillar or point of Europe, the corrupt and familiar appellation of Gibraltar, Gebel el Tariq, describes the mountain of Tariq, and the entrenchments of his camp were the first outline of those fortifications which, in the hands of our countrymen, have resisted the art and power of the House of Bourbon. The adjacent governors informed the court of Toledo of the descent and progress of the Arabs, and the defeat of his lieutenant Idigo, who had been commanded to seize and bind the presumptuous strangers, admonished Roderick of the magnitude of the danger. At the royal summons, the dukes and counts, the bishops and nobles of the Gothic monarchy, assembled at the head of their followers, and the title of King of the Romans, which is employed by an Arabic historian, may be excused by the close affinity of language, religion, and manners between the nations of Spain. His army consisted of 90 or 100,000 men, a formidable power if their fidelity and discipline had been adequate to their numbers. The troops of Tariq had been augmented to 12,000 Saracens. But the Christian malcontents were attracted by the influence of Julian, and a crowd of Africans most greedily tasted the temporal blessings of the Quran. In the neighborhood of Cadiz, the town of Xeres has been illustrated by the encounter which determined the fate of the kingdom. The stream of the Guadalix